From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Teich. Today on the show, a new report says many of Milwaukee's cultural institutions face immense capital challenges. Later, a Milwaukee man works to open a sports center with a level playing field.
We would have accessible equipment there that whether you're able-bodied or disabled, you could get in and use, and now everybody has the chance to be on a level playing field and play together.
Plus, the story of a Wisconsin contribution to Christmas, the aluminum tree.
They started out as straight needle, and they added the pom-pom tips to the end there. And then they did things like frosted the needles, basically crimping aluminum chaff.
And the NFL and GE Healthcare work on improving MRI technology. Lake Effect comes your way next, after the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich. Thanks so much for tuning in. As we heard on yesterday's show, the Milwaukee Symphony Orchestra is trying to raise $5 million in the next few weeks to continue operating. Symphony leaders say the cash infusion is needed to deal with immediate challenges, such as reducing its substantial deficit. But the MSO is not the only cultural institution facing questions about the future. From the Milwaukee County Zoo to the BMO Harris Bradley Center, many of the places on the city's cultural landscape are also seeing looming issues ahead. This morning, the Public Policy Forum has released a major report on the state of the area's arts, cultural, recreational, and entertainment institutions and finds their needs immense. Rob Henkin is president of the nonpartisan research organization. He's with us in the studio to talk more about the latest report. Welcome back to Lake Effect.
Well, thanks for having me, Mitch.
Give us some insight into the scope of this work you've done. It is a pretty ambitious, wide-ranging report. What's the key question you were setting out to answer?
You know, Mitch, there's been a lot of conversation in this community over the years, in particular about the county-owned arts and cultural institutions and the parks, and does the Milwaukee County government have the wherewithal to appropriately take care of those? The primary focus, again, of this report is that issue, but we wanted to expand it because the key question on the table for this community is, do we want to do anything new or different in terms of how we are going to take care of these assets and these organizations that inhabit these assets? And if that's the case, are we only talking about the county-owned institutions or the whole wide array of arts and cultural and entertainment institutions in the region? So in addition to looking at the county-owned, we looked at a half dozen of the major privately owned arts and cultural organizations, as well as the three major sports and convention facilities.
Well, and so starting with the county is the issue that you used to get into it. What do you see as the headline here? Is the state of the arts for county-owned and operated arts institutions any different than the privately owned institutions you looked at?
I think we do see some differences. I think without question, the operating challenges facing some of the county-owned institutions are more severe than on the privately owned side. That being said, I think a very interesting and key finding of our report that if you had to make a choice between doing something to better support the capital side of the equation versus the operating side, you probably would want to go with the capital side even for the county-owned institutions. I think what we're seeing is that reliance on public sector support is a double-edged sword. On the one hand, assuming that it is relatively stable, it helps to offset those fluctuations in earned revenues and private contributions that can occur when the economy isn't doing well. But that's a big if. Oftentimes, when the economy isn't doing well, that's when government is most pinched, and that's where those funding streams are threatened. And so you don't want to be in a position where you're becoming too dependent on public dollars. On the capital improvement side, I think what we're seeing is that there's a lot of difficulty with the nuts and bolts maintenance and repairs. I think even though the public museum and the zoo and other entities are taking place in publicly owned buildings, there's been some success in terms of raising private dollars for big improvements. The welcoming center at the zoo is a perfect example of that. Some of the recent investments in the museum, other examples. Where it gets more difficult is trying to convince private donors to make up for the county's inability to take care of HVAC systems and roofs and facades.
which are the sort of less sexy capital improvements. How did we get here? What has happened? You know, not too long ago, we talked about the state of the Milwaukee County budget, and the news was cautiously optimistic. But this seems to run counter to the county at large. What's happened to get us to this point?
I think there's two big factors that have taken several years to accumulate that have allowed us to now reach this very dire set of circumstances. Number one is that when you think back to how county government was created, the fundamental premise was that county government as an agent of state government is to provide certain mandated services. Public safety, health and human services are the ones that really rise to the top. The judiciary is another, for which there's going to be reimbursement from the state and federal governments to do that. Over time, the county also decided to take on, with the approval of the state legislature, many discretionary services. And the main discretionary services are the parks, the cultural institutions, the transit system. Those services ostensibly were to be funded primarily with the local tax revenues, whereas the mandated services with the state and federal revenues. What we have seen over time, in part because those federal and state revenues have not increased with inflation, also in part because of expenditure pressures from the county benefits issues and so on, that the state and federal dollars have not been able to keep pace with the expenditure needs for the mandated projects. That in turn has caused more local property tax and sales tax to have to be dedicated to those functions, leaving fewer resources for the parks and cultural institutions. So that's number one. Number two is that the county made a decision to refinance the bulk of its long-term debt about 10 years ago, and in doing so realized that it could not continue to borrow at traditional rates. So the county has very prudently limited its annual borrowing to accommodate that, but it really has not kept pace with the needs of these aging buildings and structures and parkways, et cetera.
Is there a value judgment to be made here about these issues as a priority versus the other kinds of issues that the Public Policy Forum typically looks at, things like municipal budgets and education and transit?
Well, quite honestly, that's where we run into some trouble here, because what we can do is we can lay out the needs. We very pointedly do not want to make that value judgment. We can't tell taxpayers and policymakers whether the needs that we have identified for the arts and cultural and entertainment institutions exceed those facing schools and libraries and roads and transportation systems. What we can say, however, that if indeed it is a community priority to essentially keep what we have, then I think much as we view our transportation infrastructure, there's a need to look at major cyclical investments. And in this case, based on our assessment, clearly there's a lack of resources to take care of these facilities right now.
So if that's the state of things for the county-owned and operated arts institutions and cultural facilities, how does it relate to what private organizations are going through right now? For example, the Milwaukee Symphony Orchestra is right now embarking on this campaign to raise $5 million. Is that emblematic of the state of things for private institutions?
I think that the symphony is certainly an outlier. The set of circumstances that has caused them to have to look at some major changes to their business model are somewhat unique, but really not unique in sort of their form, but unique in their scope and their size. Fundamentally, I think where the private organizations struggle is they are so dependent on earned revenue and private contributions that during times of downturn, they have to dip into reserves, they have to defer maintenance. Where their needs are greatest is in they could use some better endowments and reserves to be able to accommodate those swings in their revenue streams, to be able to take care of basic infrastructure needs. But they certainly aren't as lacking of the day-to-day resources that they need. And several of the ones we looked at are doing just fine. I think where there's a huge correlation here, however, is when you look at big capital improvements. Here's where the private sector organizations have been quite successful in raising money for some very big projects. The Milwaukee Youth Arts Center is one of the entities that we looked at. The problem is that as the county-owned institutions are growing more and more reliant on private dollars to take care of their major capital projects, they're competing with the other institutions. And so the question is there enough capacity in our philanthropic community to take care of these needs? And if not, what are we going to do about that?
In some ways, it seems like not that the solutions are any easier, but the economics of the private institutions are a lot easier to wrap one's head around than the major issues that the county-owned organizations are dealing with.
I think that's true. And I think each one has some very key private sector donors who have been very generous, who they can count on for big needs. It's the smaller needs, and it's the, again, the year-to-year volatility and being able to maintain their program and their earned revenues in the face of that volatility.
Now, where private meets public is in the sports arena. There's been a lot of attention paid to the future of the BMO Harris Bradley Center, but are the issues with the Bradley Center emblematic of issues facing sports facilities and things like the Wisconsin Center at large?
Somewhat so, yes. So we by no means did a rigorous review of the Bradley Center and its physical needs, but we did review the Bradley Center's finances. And I think what struck us, Mitch, is that when you look at how the Bradley Center is going to try to scrape by over the next several years until a decision is made on a new arena and until the current lease with the Bucks expires in 2017, they now are looking much like our private and public arts and cultural organizations in that they are seeking public dollars. They are seeking contributions from philanthropy and the business community. They're getting those. There was a big push by the chamber to provide the Bucks with some business contributions. There have been two $5 million state grants. There's an appropriation in this year's city budget. So the question is, can the Bradley Center continue, the BMO Harris Bradley Center, can it continue to exist under that type of model? The problem there is what happens if the Bucks do indeed leave. We cannot tell you whether if there is not a new or renovated arena that the Bucks indeed will leave when the lease expires. But what we can tell you is that if they do leave, they would take with them more than half of the annual earned revenue that that facility is enjoying, and the facility's expenditure needs would not go away. The deferred maintenance that they're facing is a big example.
You also looked at Miller Park and essentially in the ongoing way Miller Park has worked to retire its debt.
Yes, and it's clearly that's proceeding according to schedule. The latest numbers show that the sales tax may indeed be able to be retired by about 2018. One of the things that we found interesting is that there is also a need to take care of an annual contribution from the stadium district into a fund that ensures that going forward between 2018 and the early 2030s, when the lease with the Brewers expires, there is a source of funding to take care of regular maintenance even after the sales tax expires. So clearly there would be an opportunity potentially to do something else with that revenue stream. Again, whether that's what taxpayers and policymakers want to do is the big question on the table.
Are there success stories that you found as you looked into this particular arts organizations or cultural organizations that have really done it right?
There are several. I mean, we have a very strong and vibrant community, and that's in large measure due to the generosity of philanthropy here in this city. We looked at the ballet and the Milwaukee Rep, each of which struggled right around the time of the economic recession and even before. Beforehand, they did some restructuring. They found ways to boost earned revenues, and they're doing fine on an annual basis. I think, again, their issue is sort of the nagging long-term need to take care of their buildings that are growing older, and do they have the capacity to do that, particularly if we have another cyclical downturn?
Well, and one key issue that the report does not tackle is how each of these institutions might right the ship. Is that where this work is going?
I think that is where this work is going. And again, this is not the public policy forum saying we have to do anything at all. But what we will be looking at is if indeed this community does want to do something, how would you do something? And there are several different models from other places that we're going to be looking at. We are going to do some modeling ourselves. And our hope is to be able to inform this debate so that if indeed there's talk about a new or enhanced dedicated public funding source, that hopefully it's directed toward the right places so that it's actually effective.
Rob Henkin, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Rob Henkin is president of the Milwaukee-based Public Policy Forum. The group's new report is called Pulling Back the Curtain, Assessing the Needs of Major Arts, Cultural, Recreational, and Entertainment Assets in Milwaukee County. They'll present it to the MMAC's task force looking at the downtown arena issue later today. You'll find a link to the report from wuwm.com/lakeeffect. While the needs for existing sports and entertainment facilities are great, another unique sports facility is looking to get off the ground. We'll hear about it when Lake Effect returns on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich. Our next segment is about a remarkable community resource. There's just one catch. It's not yet built. But if Damian Buchman has his way, it will be, and within the next couple of years. But let's take a step back. In fact, step is the operative word because the people for whom the Ability Center will be most useful can take a step neither forward nor back without help. Buchman himself suffered from childhood cancer and almost lost both legs, but he grew up to be an active, athletic adult and wanted to give others the opportunity as well. His vision is to build a community sports center for people of all abilities, disabled and able-bodied. Buchman tells Lake Effect's Bonnie North that the Ability Center is based on the concept of reverse inclusion.
We live in a world where we build things that are supposedly accessible for those with disabilities through the ADA code of law. The Ability Center is really about being inclusive and designed universally for people with disabilities while inviting in the able-bodied public. So it's a complete paradigm shift of the way we see things and build things today. And actually, if something works for those with disabilities, it absolutely works for those who are the able-bodied public.
So now the Ability Center is it's a gym, right? Is that the basic idea?
Yeah. A gym sounds pretty generic. Yeah. But the vision is actually the first of its kind in the U.S. It entails 230,000 square feet. And to put that in perspective, it's like the size of a super Walmart. And it's about fitness. It's about athletics, swimming, running, the whole bit. It's more of an athletic facility with a fitness component versus which you'll see in most fitness areas are a fitness facility that happen to have a court. So we're kind of the reverse of that.
So the idea is to get everybody doing something physical.
Absolutely. Everybody having access and opportunity to that same level of being fit, active, and healthy that their able-bodied peers do. And that's exactly what the basis is behind the vision of the Ability Center, is giving that same daily opportunity that says, I don't want to have to go at the time that's scheduled for me for my practice or a program or whatever that is. It's 1 o'clock. I'm on the couch. I'm bored. I want to go now. And that's what the Ability Center's goal is a daily opportunity to be fit, active, healthy, and to play.
Besides some of the obvious reasons why people with disabilities can't do that, what are some of the things that are there that are obstacles that we who are able-bodied might not realize?
I think, essentially we as an organization and myself have boiled it down to two words, and that's two that I've already mentioned, which is access and opportunity. So it's first of all very important that you have access to the necessary adaptive equipment to use, and that could be whether it's a physical disability or an intellectual disability, that you actually have access to the equipment that's modified to your special needs, whether that's athletic equipment, cardio equipment, or strength equipment. But then once you have access to that, you have to have the opportunity to use it. So there's great organizations out there like the Challenge Athletes Foundation that gives grants to people with physical disabilities to get, say, a prosthetic running leg, to get a wheelchair, a sport athletic wheelchair to use. But it doesn't matter if they have that wheelchair or that leg if they don't have a place to use it. So that's where opportunity comes in. The Ability Center giving that option, that space, that accessible, inclusive, affordable space to actually use the equipment that either you have yourself or that we would provide for you at the Ability Center.
Now, what about the people who will be working there? Is there special training that goes into working with athletes who have disabilities?
What the Ability Center will have is not just a personal trainer, but that personal trainer would first be experienced in recreational therapy and or physical therapy, and then on top of that, have the accreditation to be a personal trainer. So they first understand the body and needs of somebody with some form of disability or a special need more than they understand the general human body and the way that that works in its perfection and completion and just the idea of the concept of an able body, then this is the way it was supposed to work. So they would have the knowledge of special needs of individuals before they had the knowledge of just how to train a normal working body, if you will.
Do you see this as being, you said, sort of an athletic center first? Mm-hmm. Are you imagining teams? Are you imagining some sort of Ability Center, uniform that people will be wearing going out into the community?
Yeah, I think that would be amazing. I mean, within the Ability Center and within our DNA lives collaboration. So one of the biggest things that we're not doing and our focus is not going to be is to reinvent the wheel. We want to enhance the wheel that already exists. There's already great organizations out there like Special Olympics, Milwaukee Recreation, Great Lakes Adaptive Sports Association. These are organizations that are providing adaptive services to people with disabilities, but they don't have the space and time to do it, let's say, during normal business hours, slash 18 hours a day. So we want organizations like that to come in, use our affordable, accessible, inclusive space in the Ability Center and actually enhance the programming that they already offer. So we do envision teams. You may have seen the Guinness commercial recently that came out. And we've been very flattered by the number of people who have tagged us on Facebook or emailed or asked us if we saw it because they are starting to understand what the Ability Center is about. In that commercial, there's a bunch of gentlemen playing wheelchair basketball. And at the end of their wheelchair basketball space, all but one stand up after their game. So all these able-bodied individuals were actually playing with their one disabled friend, and they had the first opportunity to play together because that's the same concept of the Ability Center. We would have accessible equipment there that whether you're able-bodied or disabled, you could get in and use, and now everybody has the chance to be on a level playing field and play together. That's what we're looking for. We're looking for that recreational space, that opportunity where you can just come and play. Because most adaptive sports are competitive. And believe me, I'm uber competitive. But in any demographic, there isn't a large percentage of individuals who want to be competitive, who want to have to practice a couple nights a week, who want to travel around the country to have to play. So they really just are looking for that same opportunity to just recreate and just have fun.
Social leagues.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely social leagues. I used to run a sports facility in Waukesha. It's what my professional career was. And we provided the opportunity for youth volleyball, youth basketball, adult volleyball, and they had the choice of multiple hours a night, multiple days a week to come and play and be in these social leagues. When I realized that that opportunity isn't out there for people with disabilities, I started to have a sincere problem with that and say, this is a problem that's easily solvable. We just need the space to give them.
So where is this space going to be?
You know, we're hoping to build in Milwaukee County, potentially somewhere around the medical campus in Wauwatosa is the goal. More than anything, because it doesn't matter how accessible a building is that you make or you build, if people can't access it, they have to be able to get there. And while it's on the outskirts of Milwaukee County, it's still within the confines and it's off of the heaviest traveled bus line for the transit system. And then there's the transit plus van line system that people with disabilities use. And so they would be able to access the campus through that as well. So in the entirety of southeastern Wisconsin, there's 190,000 people who report a disability. 100,000 of those in that seven-county radius are in Milwaukee County. So it's vitally important that we're in Milwaukee County to serve the most need and fulfill our mission, but also to be accessible to that transportation piece and start to eliminate barriers. So, you know, Milwaukee County Transit goes all over Milwaukee County, but the question starts to become, how many transfers does one have to make from bus to bus to bus until they can actually get to that location? So being somewhere near the medical campus would actually eliminate numerous needs for transfers. And it would also be a one transfer from Waukesha County Transit to Milwaukee County Transit for Waukesha County individuals in order to access the Ability Center.
How close are you to actually breaking ground?
Our timeline right now is we're going to be launching our capital campaign somewhere between the spring and fall of 2014. We hope to then break ground in the spring of 2015 and be open by the summer of 2016.
Okay, so pretty ambitious.
Pretty ambitious, absolutely, yeah. Absolutely.
And how has support been so far?
The support has been great, truthfully. People are looking for that one big domino to fall, and once that falls, it's literally that domino's thereafter. Philanthropists out there, community leaders see the vision, understand the vision, believe that there's a tremendous need for it. We recently had a conversation with a community leader who nailed it on the head when he said the Ability Center could be a jewel in Milwaukee's crown, and he couldn't be more right. The vision of this is not just about an athletic and a fitness center and a place for people to play, but ultimately to collaborate with an institution such as the Milwaukee Regional Medical Center to conduct research on how do we train people with disabilities to become the ultimate goal to actually Ability Center certify locations around the country. So, you know, at times I've likened the vision of the Ability Center to the March of Dimes, right? March of Dimes was founded to cure polio. They did that. And then they found a new cause. I look at the Ability Center much like that. If we are able to Ability Center certify, whether it's Wisconsin Athletic Clubs or YMCAs of the world or the Gold's Gyms of the world or the 24-Hour Fitnesses of the world, where they become more accessible to their community and those with disabilities in their community, that pushes our members out of the Ability Center doors, we would have fulfilled our mission.
Why do you think that this has not been approached in this way nationally before? Why is Milwaukee on the forefront here? Is that you?
Interesting question. To some degree, I believe it's me. You know, the backstory with me is I actually have an ambulatory disability myself from childhood cancer. I'm one in a billion survivor of my diagnosis. I've had 32 surgeries since I was 13 years old, 22 knee replacements and revisions since that time as well. I live in the possibility every day of my life of becoming a bilateral above knee amputee. And that's where the passion and the drive and the vision comes for the Ability Center. I was eventually, after a surgery, forced into wheelchair sports. For a while, I was able to play and manipulate the little bit of ability I did have standing up to play volleyball. When I finally had a surgery to be in less pain than I was currently in, that took away a lot of my ability. And so I was forced for the first time to get in a wheelchair and play wheelchair sports. And I fell in love. And then that's when I realized the opportunity for me to play anytime was existing for me to play volleyball was no longer an option. It was unacceptable. It was not okay. So to some degree, I think the vision of the Ability Center and myself as its founder are the driving force, certainly in Milwaukee. And sometimes it takes that as dreamers that's not okay with the status quo. I recently watched the Steve Jobs movie, Jobs, and I was not aware of his quote where he made a comment, something along the lines of, the people who are crazy enough to believe they can change the world are the ones who usually do. And that's so true. That's so true. I have for 4 years held this space that the vision of the Ability Center can change the world. I have for 4 years held the space that the purpose of my survivorship, where doctors thought from Milwaukee here at Children's Milwaukee right here to Sloan Kettering Memorial in New York, didn't think that I would make it to my 15th birthday. And because I've made it to my 35th birthday and beyond and here coming up, I absolutely believe that my purpose of survivorship is to deliver this vision of the Ability Center. And it's hard to stop somebody who has a belief.
And, you know, Damien, I wish you the best of luck.
Thank you.
And I hope you'll come back when it opens. And maybe we'll do a tour around and talk to some people who actually are coming in to play some sports.
I think it would be amazing, right? It would be great to get you in a wheelchair and kind of discover what some of this accessibility stuff is we're talking
about. Exactly. I mean, to me, that's the interesting part, too, is getting able-bodied people to understand what you both lose and gain.
Absolutely. Well, sometimes we talk about the wheelchair, or the sport wheelchair, for example, and we liken it to a pair of shoes. So in order for a general able-bodied individual to play basketball, they need a $50 to $100 pair of shoes. Well, that pair of shoes for somebody with a physical disability is $2,500. Who's got $2,500 in their back pocket to buy that pair of shoes?
Yeah, not
me. We want to be able to support that. We want to be able to provide that there at the Ability Center for anybody to get in and try.
Well, again, I wish you the best of luck, and thank you so much for coming in today.
Oh, thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
Damien Buchman is founder and executive director of the Ability Center. He spoke with Bonnie North. There is more information about the center's plans at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. Keep listening. We'll take a trip to Madison and a unique historical and reflective Christmas tree display when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. Of Lake Effect Now. I'm Mitch Teich. WUWM environmental reporter Susan Benz has covered a lot of stories about Wisconsin's natural trees, the vast stretches of forest that make up the North Woods. But today, Susan gets an up-close and personal look at a Wisconsin tree that is all but extinct and anything but natural. More than 20 of them are on display in Madison in the Wisconsin Historical Society Museum. The trees are aluminum. They're Christmas trees made by a Wisconsin company back when they were all the rage in the 1960s. Joseph Kapler is curator of the Wisconsin Historical Society's Museums and Historical Sites Division. He guided Susan through the exhibit called "Tis the Season."
Joseph Kapler's eyes gleam with pride as he looks at the centerpiece of the exhibit, a rare pink Evergleen Christmas tree. Rare because of a certain 1965 animated TV special.
Because this is the tree that Lucy referenced in the 1965 Charlie Brown special. She wanted to get an aluminum tree, perhaps painted pink.
Get the biggest aluminum tree you can find, Charlie Brown. Maybe painted pink.
But the pink tree of Lucy's dreams is only one of nearly two dozen Evergleens in the first floor gallery.
Everything here that we're looking at, we would collect and preserve, just like we do widgets and gadgets and wedding dresses and archival collections and letters and furniture. This because it's a Wisconsin product. All these were made in Manitowoc, Wisconsin.
Aluminum Specialties became the largest manufacturer of trees and at its peak employed 750 people to make trees that evolved over time.
They started out as straight needle and they added the pom-pom tips. And then they did things like frosted the needles, basically crimping aluminum chaff, to give it more angles to reflect light and shinier. And there's also different types of aluminum stock, so some have a higher luster than others. Within a few years, they started making colored trees, gold and green. We have 4-foot trees, but the bulk are the 6- and 7-foot trees, and we have one gold 8-foot tree in the back.
Kapler calls his collection of 22 trees a forest. While the gallery's north wall is lined with evergreens, forest seems a bit puffed up. But Kapler says compare it to his first show 8 years ago.
We worked hard to get about 7 trees, and we had some lent as well.
He uses what he's got to maximum effect through lighting.
Here in the gallery, we've put colored light from above. We've dimmed the gallery. We have some color wheels going as well. So trying to recreate that mood, if you will.
It seems to be working on a mother and her young daughter. They plunk down on the floor and gaze treeward, seemingly mesmerized. According to Kapler, during the 1960s, the aluminum tree evoked strong reactions, from distaste to delight. But he says the manufacturer did not set out to replace the traditional live Christmas tree.
The idea is you didn't hang ornaments on these trees. You splashed light on them. They were so very different from the traditional Christmas tree. It's not an artificial tree. That's one that's plastic, and it's meant to mimic a tree and look real. It is what it is. It's an aluminum Christmas tree. You can call it sculpture if you want. So no ornaments, and then you would splash light on it, perhaps moving light.
David Moore has his own memories of an evergreen his parents owned when he grew up in Minnesota.
It's kind of like the ones on the floor here, but a little bit bigger. But not only that, the whole tree stand, like the one they have in this place, would turn, and it was gold, and it played music at the same time.
Although he says the tree stood regally in their living room window, unlike curator Joseph Kapler's depiction, Moore and his brother were allowed to decorate their evergreen.
We didn't have the glass balls because afraid of me knocking them off as a kid, or me and my brother. So we went with a plastic kind of yarnish around it, blue ball, and they're blue on it, and then once in a while we do popcorn on a string on it, or paper chain, or other colored tinsel on that tree.
Evergreens are fetching hefty prices these days on eBay. That could not have been said for the Moore family tree. He says he and his brother wore it out. Curator Joseph Kapler points out enclosed cases of surviving evergreen artifacts. As much as the trees themselves, he covets their accessories and, above all, its packaging.
So we're looking at the remnants of two boxes. To buy one tree, a consumer would have to buy two boxes worth, and then you'd have these dotted lines. You had to cut the top off. And then what was underneath when you found out was all these branches, probably all about 90 of them, each individually stuck into a wooden base. It's a heavy wooden base. The trunk is painted, and the base would have to be assembled with screws every time. So, good idea. People liked them, but to make it great, it did what you see over here on the right. On the right is just a box that's less than half the size of these other two, and what the company did is they partnered with Modern Coatings Incorporated out of Chicago. They're the ones who first introduced an aluminum tree in the late 50s.
Jerry Walk vividly remembers the evolution of evergreen. He was a regional salesman and later VP of marketing and sales for Aluminum Specialties. I reached him at his home in Manitowoc.
The company, Aluminum Specialties, always had Christmas parties for two customers, Montgomery Ward and Ben Franklin stores in Chicago. And the Christmas decoration buyer said to my boss at the time, was Vice President Tom Gannon, I got to show you something.
A large aluminum Christmas tree.
A beautiful tree, but it was very, very high priced. They sold a 4-foot tree, it was like $75. 6-foot tree was $100.
A lot of money at that time.
A lot of money. This was 1958. And in a big box.
Like the bulky one on display at the Wisconsin Historical Museum show.
And the buyer said, the challenge you have here is to get this price down where you can sell it for $25 at the most, and get it into a box where we can put a mass display in our stores, and a customer can look at it, pick up a box, they can check out, and take it home. So this is 2 weeks before Christmas.
Walk says their engineering team set to work, and 3 months later, they had put together
4 trees, exactly what the buyer wanted, and we took it to New York for the toy show. The first customer I worked with was out of Minneapolis, and it was a woman buyer, and she loved it. Loved the tree.
She placed an order on the spot, and not a conservative one.
It was just under $50,000. And I'll tell you, at that time, with our toy line, where we were selling items for, you know, $1, $2, and $3 like this, a $25,000 order was big.
Walk says over the next several years, the aluminum specialties plant was pumping out Evergleams 24/7, 10 months a year. And in fact, the tree lived on in the market for 13 years. Joseph Kapler says the Wisconsin Historical Society intends to hold on to what remains, as many Evergleams as its pocketbook will allow, along with family photos around their aluminum trees, as well as in store windows that people like Jerry Walk were responsible for.
One of the marketing innovations that Jerry Walk and others had is finding new and different places to retail these. And one of the ideas they thought of in the 1960s, a lot of automotive supply stores, and a lot of them, in the downtown central business districts. And, well, in December, there's not a lot of need for tires and things like that. So they convinced a lot of these automotive parts retailers, sell Evergleams. Put these up, and you got all that glass in the front of your building. Put these up and give people reason to come into your... And so it's thinking like that as well, that, you know, great sales thinking and along with great product development thinking.
Thinking that's still paying dividends a half century later. For Like Effect, I'm Susan Bentz.
The Wisconsin Historical Society Museum's exhibit of Evergleams continues through January 11th in Madison. At the same time, the museum is holding a retro holiday photo contest. You'll find more information about it and photos of Susan's Evergleam experience at wuwm.com/likeeffect. One last break, and then how one area company is working to better diagnose brain injuries in professional and maybe someday in amateur sports. That story when Lake Effect returns on WUWM. Like Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio now. I'm Mitch Teich. The Green Bay Packers season continues Sunday afternoon with a game against the Dallas Cowboys. It'll likely be another struggle for the Packers, but it's struggle of a different sort for players sitting out as a result of head injuries. The NFL has been sued by former players who said not enough was done to protect them from concussions, but the NFL points to proactive measures it says it's taking to protect players today. One of those is a partnership, the Head Health Initiative, with the Milwaukee area's GE Healthcare. It provides funding for developing the next generation of MRI devices, which could make diagnosing brain injuries easier. Baldev Ahuwalia is the premium segment manager in MRI for GE Healthcare. He joined us earlier this fall. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much, Mitch. I appreciate the opportunity to be here.
What is the ultimate aim of this partnership that the GE has entered into with the NFL?
Well, Mitch, it has multiple goals. The first goal is to improve our understanding and education of traumatic brain injury and make sure we can better understand how it's diagnosed and what the prognosis would be. The second one is to understand what technologies could be better used to better detect traumatic brain injury. And the third one is product development, taking our understanding and learning from both clinical research and development and product development and apply that into products and make it available in the marketplace.
Where does the technology currently stand? What's the weak point that you're seeking to address that can make things better?
It's a very interesting question. You know, MR is an incredibly sensitive tool today. It is probably one of the most sensitive tools to evaluate and look at the brain. It is also one of the later stages or tools used in the diagnosis or determine what treatment should be used for a patient. And in specific to traumatic brain injury, it is also a tool that's used, but it's not, I believe, has the resolution or capabilities that's needed today to do a better evaluation of somebody who may be concussed or who've had a traumatic brain injury.
Well, and let's take a step even further back than that. We talk about MRI. It stands for magnetic resonance imaging. But what exactly is it? In a nutshell, how does it work?
Well, an MRI, as you said, magnetic resonance imaging, uses a very strong magnetic field and radio waves to look at really the distribution of water in the tissue, how the water or protons specifically is bound to different types of tissue, white matter, gray matter, fat, cerebrospinal fluid in your blood, and look how that changes over different parameters. So they're typically in an MRI exam when you may go in the brain, a physician will maybe prescribe 5 or 6 different ways of looking at the brain. And they'll use those 5 or 6 different methods of looking at the brain to put together a puzzle to determine what the issue may be. Sometimes they'll do an acquisition which is very sensitive to blood, sometimes an acquisition which is very sensitive to white matter or gray matter in the brain. And they'll compose a picture to determine what the diagnosis would be.
So when you're talking about being able to improve the resolution in order to achieve stronger results, what are we able to see today, and what might we be able to see given this partnership and further developments in the field?
Well, today we can see many impressive things. We can see stroke incredibly well. We can see how the brain is perfused with blood very well. We can see anatomical changes well. But what we don't understand clearly is all the things that may change specifically with concussion, what's the rate of change, and how sensitive does the device need to be so that we can actually monitor that change over time. You know, in preparation for this meeting, you highlighted functional magnetic resonance imaging. And that is a very exquisite tool and a very sensitive tool for looking at changes and minute changes in blood flow based on, you know, activation of area parts of the brain. That is one tool today that we will be advancing to improve the diagnostic or prognostic capabilities of an MRI scanner to evaluate traumatic brain injury. The other ones are, you know, things like microbleeds. Depending upon the level of impact or the type of concussion, you can have very small microbleeds. It is felt, I should say, that there can be small microbleeds based upon the severity of the concussion. And if there are microbleeds, it may take you longer to recover. We had a medical advisory board in May of this year. And the medical advisory board was made up of people from the NCAA, the NFL medical advisories, the Department of Defense, good partners of General Electric. And what it is product development is a team sport. And this is not something that we can do alone. We need really good partners and partners across multiple facets. One of those critical goals at the beginning is understand and improve our understanding and education of how MR may be applied to evaluate and improve traumatic brain injury. And that's the part of the medical advisory board. They're collaborators with us, and they help us understand where else we should look and improve the capabilities of the scanner to then migrate what should go into product and why.
We think about the number of people, I mean, the very high-profile people who are dealing with traumatic brain injury are often NFL players, other sports as well. Is one of the roles that the NFL is going to be playing in this partnership, are they providing you with athletes who are in need of this kind of diagnosis?
No, they're not providing athletes in need of the diagnosis. That is specifically the responsibility of the research and development is General Electric. It's a partnership with the NFL to help us understand what might be best applied in their realm. But the goals here is not specific to the NFL. The goal for General Electric is to improve the capabilities for anybody who may need the technology, whether that be, you know, my son when he's out riding his bike, or a car accident on the playing field, the Department of Defense. It's very much a very broad spectrum. It's not a focused solution that we're looking for.
How much of what needs to be done is technology that may already exist in its infancy and needs the funding to scale up? And how much of this is about technology that does not even exist yet?
It's a bit of both. There is technology that we have today in-house. Coming from a research development background, technology only has a benefit when you put it in the hands of a clinician. It's one thing to have it running as a prototype at an evaluation site, but it only has the significant positive impact when you move it to the hands of a clinician and they get to use it every day or in the cases that they have. So there's technology that we have today that I believe can have an important factor in improving the ability to diagnose and prognose traumatic brain injury. There's other ones we don't know yet. So one of the great parts of my role is that I get to work with some incredibly smart people and develop impressive tools. As I said, this is a team sport, and there's a lot of things we don't know. But I think there are things that in the MRI scanner today that can improve our capabilities or a physician's capabilities of diagnosing traumatic brain injury. If you go for a routine neurologic MRI exam today, it is not optimized to evaluate. I don't believe, I should say. It's optimized to evaluate traumatic brain injury. I think there's a lot of things that we need to do to improve those capabilities and the sensitivity of the device to what we expect may be changing in the brain.
If your child was injured, had a head injury, how confident would you be that the MRI that they get when they're taken to the doctor the next day is able to detect the severity of what's wrong with them?
I think it's also why you have tertiary care centers and more outpatient facilities. You know, in those situations, you want to take them to the best facility that is available to you and trust the physicians that you have. And I would trust that they have the capabilities, and they would have the capabilities to understand what best to do.
Is the objective to have equipment then that could exist at any given football stadium or in many, many, many more hospitals so that an athlete who is injured or whoever who is injured has access to this, or is this still going to be the kind of thing that will exist primarily at say trauma centers?
No, I think this is key technology that will become available to a broad spectrum of facilities. And when I say facilities, I mean healthcare providers. And it's not going to be solely to trauma centers because the follow-up from traumatic brain injury is not necessarily days or weeks. It is years in some situations. And the technology is available, I believe, from an evaluation standpoint, from a long-term chronic management of traumatic brain injury, that it can be done at a more outpatient facility. It's the continual evaluation and understanding of the changes over time that MR does not do incredibly well today, or we don't use those tools well today. MR is traditionally a very qualitative exam, and it's moving relatively rapidly towards a quantitative tool.
The NFL has another simultaneous partnership going with the equipment manufacturer Under Armour to look at improving safety through equipment. Is there any overlap in the Venn diagram, if you will? Is there a connection between what they're doing with equipment and what you are doing with diagnosis and treatment?
We are partners, and the partners with Under Armour and partners with the NFL, a lot of that information is very easily and quickly shared. So if somebody comes out with a brand new type of mouth guard that they suspect or believe will reduce the severity of a concussion, it may not have a play in what we do, but getting that to market is a critical thing.
This is a huge deal in professional sports and amateur sports today, in military settings. Is it an exciting challenge to be taking on?
It's a very exciting challenge, and it's also really important for trauma. You know, trauma is probably the biggest cause of traumatic brain injury globally, and when in the United States, it's anything on wheels or anything associated with wheels. It's very exciting. Anytime I talk to the team or any friend or colleague about what we're doing with traumatic brain injury, they all say, I know somebody, or it's affected me this way personally. So emotionally, it's very strong. With that emotion comes high motivation. And if the rate of change is so great, then all the better.
This is a partnership with many different stakeholders, but what do you see the NFL doing in the context of this partnership?
In the context of the partnership, well, primarily we have common goals in this partnership. The primary role is funding. You know, it's a joint development. GE is putting in $30 million. The NFL is putting in $30 million. And that $30 million goes to three things. One is challenge grants to quickly migrate technology that's in the hands of anybody who has intellectual property and move that into the marketplace or advance it so that it could potentially be better evaluated. Completing research and development. So there's $10 million to clinical research and development to determine what should go into GE MRI products. And the last component is MRI product development in itself, which is $30 million. So the NFL's goals and GE goals in this joint development are common, and their responsibility is financial, which is equal in partnership with GE as well.
Are you anticipating – obviously things are early on in this partnership, but are you going to work with team physicians, say, and just talk to them about the kinds of challenges that they have? I mean, where are they going to be involved in any part of this, or is this essentially going to be a finished product by the time it gets to a football setting?
So there's a couple things. One is that we've actually worked very closely with University of Purdue. They have done a lot of work with high school players, and they work very closely with the athletic trainers who are on the sidelines, who are seeing the issues on a day-to-day basis and understanding how best to treat the patient. And they're also at the same time using MR to evaluate how the athlete, student-athlete, is progressing after the concussion. Are we working with team physicians? We're working with the NFL physicians. So there's team physicians, but predominantly they have – the NFL has a consultant group of three or four physicians. Specifically, we are working with the Head, Neck, and Spine Committee, and they are part of the Medical Advisory Board to make sure that we are fully aware of the research that is going on, as well as how the NFL is managing players today. And the NFL Players Association is engaged with that closely.
Baldev Ahluwalia, thanks so much.
Thank you very much, Mitch.
Baldev Ahluwalia is the premium segment manager in MRI for GE Healthcare. The Milwaukee area company is partnering with the NFL to develop new MRI technology through the NFL's Head Health Initiative. Our interview first aired this fall. Finally today, we have a chance to listen to one of our favorite in-studio music sessions of the past year. Nick Brightwell is a recent graduate of the fingerstyle guitar program at UWM. He'll play a concert tomorrow night at the Charles Alice Museum as part of an art and music evening to raise funds for the Hunger Task Force. Here he is from earlier this year with his original tune, A Sunny Day in Milwaukee. Milwaukee-based musician Nick Brightwell and his original song, A Sunny Day in Milwaukee. He'll play tomorrow evening at the Charles Alice Museum in a fundraiser for the Hunger Task Force and as part of a larger effort to attract younger visitors to the museum. There's more information at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. That's Friday's edition of the show, produced by Dan Harmon, Stephanie Lecce, and Bonnie North, with the assistance of Eleanor Peterson and Nathan Royster, and the additional web support of Michelle Maternowski. I'm Mitch Teich. Sounds like another cold and snowy weekend. Hope we could be a bright spot in between the shoveling. Please join us again tomorrow and Sunday afternoon at 3 for Lake Effect Weekend from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. It's 11 o'clock. Stay tuned. Fresh air is next.